Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Swim podcast. Hey friends, welcome to the first Someone Who Isn't Me of 2023. And in typical Swim fashion, this one was actually recorded a little while ago. So there you go. This is episode 45, which is with Thomas Hark of Swedish metal phenomena Meshuggah. Yeah, so the interview was done back in April last year around the release of the band's latest album, Immutable, which is an album of dense intricacy and dark subject matter dealing with real dystopian ideas of surveillance, social media, and the sort of burgeoning arrival of AI. All things that I find super interesting and also really scary without wanting to sound like a kind of Amish guy that rides around in a buggy making ice cream and or meth and shuns all kind of technology, because that's not me. But you know what I'm saying. Over the course of 40 minutes, Thomas and I discussed the record and its making, the process of getting ready for tour, which actually happened shortly after this was conducted. I actually saw the band on that run at the Royal Albert Hall in London, which was stunning. Their shows are always incredible, but to see a band like that play in the Royal Albert Hall was something pretty special indeed, because obviously the place is if you've ever been there or if you've never been there, it's a really beautiful old building and concert hall in London that is generally more used to having kind of classical concerts and or stuff like Cirque du Soleil, and generally not being sort of filled with thousands of battle vest wearing metalers who are there to just absolutely wig out and lose their mind to something like Meshuggah. Actually, on that run, the support band was the wonderful Zeal and Ardor. And if you missed the conversation that I had with Zeal and Ardor frontman Manuel, you can check that out, which was episode 24 of Someone Who Isn't Me, because it's a pretty good one, I think. Anyway, saw the band play that show, which was stunning. Light show as ever, just like one of the most mind-blowing things. Also saw him in Kentucky at the Danny Wimmer Festival called Louder Than Life, which was also a truly good time. I personally always find the band very psychedelic and trance-inducing, which actually at that festival I think must have amused somebody, because I remember I got filmed vibing hard and it got sent to another mate. No apologies for feeling it, man. I love this band. Anyway, aside from the album, we talk a little bit about the themes covered in the album's lyrics. We also talk a little bit about the fact that great music has to have this ethereal component that transcends simply playing the music and the songs, and also a very little bit about the physical struggles that Thomas was having with his health regarding his hands and the challenges that was having on his playing. He is obviously one of the greatest metal drummers on the planet. Yeah, so if you don't know the band, I suggest you check out the album Immutable that we're discussing, and then work your way back through their catalogue to see the truly inspiring work that they've been making throughout their career, helping to redefine the very nature of heavy music, to be fair. This is Thomas Hark of Meshuggah. Enjoy. How's things, man?
It's pretty good. We kind of got started now and rehearsing and stuff, and you know, it's been a while, you know, since we played live. It was August 2019, so So, yeah, you definitely feel it. I mean, of course, we made an album, so we had to, you know, rehearse for that. But
it
wasn't like hard rehearsals like we did for Violent Sleep of Reason, for example, because that was live takes in the studio. So with this one being different, you know, and we knew beforehand we were going to go in and edit and like choose takes, and you know, it wasn't like knife to the throat like Violent Sleep was. So
so
physically also, you know, I'm pretty sure you felt that too, after like 2 years of COVID and like sitting on our asses in the couches, because that's my favorite hobby.
Yeah.
That's, you know, the physical shape was not the best I've been in, I'd say that.
Yeah, I think that goes for most people. I would definitely include myself in that, but that might be just me and you providing our own little support group for each other whilst everyone else
it,
has
it
been
doesn't
doing.
Matter why I like it. I like the feeling it gives me. So whatever reason, it's fine.
Yeah. Plus the thing is as well, I think that there's a real big difference between rehearsing for shows and going through things when you're recording, because that's almost a lot more piecemeal.
Absolutely.
Working out parts and going back over things.
Yep.
And there is that obviously in rehearsing for live, but they're very different things for sure.
It's a very different thing for sure. Absolutely. When we rehearse for an album, you might play half a song and then you're talking about like this and that. And then like in between songs, you might take even a coffee break, and then you go down and you play another track and you try and play it a couple times, and then you have a talk and a break again. And so it's very different, you know. Obviously, when we rehearse for live, we set up the live set with the gaps it's supposed to be, you know, once we're on stage and everything, that's kind of a crucial aspect for many. It kind of gives you an idea also going from one track into the next. Sometimes, you know, since we play to a click track, sometimes a certain song, a certain tempo is not going to work after this or that tempo. So it's kind of crucial that we do that too. So once you start rehearsing for live, it's definitely way, way harder and physically more demanding. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think I've got so much respect for the way that you lay that out, because it's the same as sorting the track listing for a record, isn't it? You've got to have those dynamics. You've got to have those moments that ebb and flow and give the whole thing life, rather than it just being, here's this, here's this, here's this.
Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. It's even, as important live on a live set as it is, like how you pace out an album, you know, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think the pacing on this record's great. I think the thing is with your band, the impact it's had on heavy music is so beyond a lot of other bands. And make of that whatever you will, but I hold that to be a truism. I feel like that at times your band has felt so unrelenting, and that was one of the things at that moment in time that really drew me to it. But I feel like this record has... not a maturity, because that would suggest that there was an immaturity to the other things, but just maybe a new aspect of looking at it, which I don't know whether that's something that comes with age. I don't know whether that's something as a reaction to the last 2 years, which have been so crazy. What do you think?
Yeah, no, first of all, I appreciate that a lot. And it's definitely that's pretty much how we feel about it, too. Like you said, maybe not necessarily more mature, but there's a little more air in there. And the production, I think, as well, like helps give it a little something that we haven't had before. I think it's a little fatter sounding. It's a little less harsh. It's a little less, you know, obtrusive or annoying. That I sometimes feel like some of our productions have been a little like, it's nice like you play it low, but once you like really crank it, it's like, oh, that's a lot. But this one, actually, the more you crank it, the more the better it sounds, kind of, I think. And you know, maturity or not, it's, you know, we go through life and we change, of course, as people with each experience. And we're now like in our early 50s, and I'm 50 years old now. Our bass player is younger. He's like a decade younger, but we're getting up there. So of course what you go through in life, your experiences, and also just the age and the longevity and the hours and years that you put into the band, of course, you know, things do change, and your approach to things, you know, your own music changes and stuff like that. But I mean, all in all, I would say we're still the same band, and with the new album Immutable kind of in a sense being somewhat of a commentary on the band, you know, and us having been around for a long time and kind of been doing the same thing, it's still not completely true. I mean, we do change a little bit, and I think even though this new album Immutable is definitely true to what we've always been doing, it still has something that sometimes it's hard to put your finger on, but it has something a little more, something orchestral vibe sometimes, and a little more symphonic vibe. So like with the layers of melody guitars and stuff like that. So it's different, you know, it's a little different.
Yeah. I think that, yeah, I was going to say to you about that, about the album title itself as this idea of this sort of unchanging, thing unaffected by the surrounding, chaos. But that is also ignoring the fact that your band has constantly distilled, I think is a good way of putting it, maybe, what you do. And I think that it's honing in, and I feel like, this record is very much a continuation of that.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I think so too. And I mean, even though, you know, Immutable, in a sense, can be applied to us as a band, it's of course more tied to, I guess, the lyrical contents of the album and the kind of the social commentary of that, and, you know, man as such, you know.
Yeah.
Just look at what's happening right now in Ukraine, and like we never change as a species, you know. It's continue with this bullshit, you know. So it's a lot more, I guess, a reflection of the lyrical contents.
Yeah, I guess that our complex being at the center of our heads is always going to have its effect, whether we like it or not, no matter how hard we try.
Yep.
I was going to say that the effects of the last 2 years have obviously had profound consequences at the world at large, and a lot of artists and musicians that I've spoken to have dealt with it in very different ways, because some found that the pandemic was this sort of void that kind of drew all the air out of the creative process, and other people reacted totally differently and found it the whole idea that this would be like a break from the cycle of it. Because I think regardless of an artist making work for themselves, you fall into these cycles as soon as your band starts to become successful, that is, you know, it's like write, record, tour, and it becomes a cycle. And I think that these last 2 years have been, having been a enforced break, has been, as I said, yeah, some people have reacted to it well, and other people have obviously found it crushingly difficult. But how was that for you guys, and how did that actually affect the record in any way, if it did?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's both things, actually. It did give you kind of a pause and a break from things, and kind of, albeit, you know, forced upon us. But for us, I would say, I mean, we were so lucky with all this. We were very fortunate because, I mean, we did like 3.5 years of touring for Violent Sleep of Reason, and we already had decided, like, the August shows we did in 19 were going to be the last, and then, you know, start writing for a new album. And so the timing, you know, we knew a lot of bands that where this really, like, just crushed them, because they just had, like, a new album, and they had tour cycles planned and stuff like that, and really the rug was swept from under them. And for us, it didn't really have that huge of an impact. We just continued as usual. I mean, most of us write separately. Morten writes up north at home, and Jens sits at home, and me and Dick, we work together a lot in this room where I'm at right now, and we co-wrote a lot of the stuff for the new album. And there was a period when the, you know, at the peak of the scare, so to speak, where we didn't, like, meet for like 4 months, but we could still continue working in the sense that we would shoot files back and forth and discuss over WhatsApp or talk on the phone and whatever. And then Dick would work from home and I would sit here and like program drums and whatever. And so we still were able to work the whole way through that pretty much. But of course it, for those like 4 or 5 months that we didn't even like meet physically, it definitely took it down to like a fifth of the tempo of creating and writing. So it had some effect, but we were very fortunate in all this actually.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's good to hear. Let's talk a bit about specifics on certain tracks on the record that I'd like to get into a bit, because I saw that you said that the opener Broken Cog was initially worked on first in like 2012 on Coloss, and then kind of circled back round when you were doing the Violent Sleep of Reason. Do you think this is me being hippie for a moment? Which is often happening. Sorry, but do you think that that things find their place in time and kind of come to fruition when the time's right, which I guess kind of suggests some kind of agency in the creative process, which a lot of people would think is nonsense. But personally, I think that is the case. I think, you know, even if things are coming together, it just the time has to be right is what I'm trying to say.
No, I agree absolutely. And I think for Broken Cog, you know, it's one of those, it's unusual for us to, this is like the one track that has ever like continued to kind of be in our minds, even though we scrapped it for Coloss, and then we kind of made like just a half-ass attempt at it for Violent Sleep, but we had so much else to do anyway, so we were like, just skip it, you know, we'll see. And so third time's the charm for this one. And I think if I look back at Coloss, how that started with I Am Colossus, and then how Violent Sleep started with Clockworks, they did a certain thing that was good for those albums, like how those albums started. And I think to a certain degree, it was not, this one was not meant to be there because it wouldn't have been a starter. And to me, it's the only thing it can be, really. And it's like, it's such, now I see it as a perfect start of an album because it's not so immediate and you don't go straight into like full on everything, yeah, you know, and once vocals kick in, it's whispers, you know. So I like that effect that it has, that it kind of slowly builds into something. And also, the kind of effect, I guess, and I'm hoping it has on the listener, like when you've heard the first track, you're like left at a like, what the hell am I supposed to, like, what's going to come next after this, you know? So there's a few different reasons I think that it worked out really well, and we're all stoked that we finally got to use it, because usually if there's a song that we've scrapped, we never come back to that. It's gone. That's done. We never really save songs for later or anything like that. If it makes it onto the album, it's worth being on the album. And if it doesn't, it wasn't supposed to be, you know. So it's kind of a one-off for us.
That's crazy, though, isn't it? Because I imagine the things that are in your waste paper basket, a lot of bands would kill for.
yeah, maybe. I mean, it's also very different depending on who you talk to in the band, like, or who you look at in the band. Morten, for example, is very prolific, and he writes so much stuff, like, and not all necessarily meant for Meshuggah. He writes a lot of like stoner, and he even has like this whole like side project in his mind that's more like arena rock / prog, like something that sounds completely different with like a lot of clean guitars and stuff like that. So he's very prolific, and he has probably hundreds of songs that is just like never been used for anything. But yeah. For the rest of us, I think we tend to more write for the album, and if it doesn't make it, it's like you just kind of, I don't think we throw them away, but I don't see us going back to them either, you know.
Yeah. So with that in mind, do you have like Is there like a almost like a thematic structure when you're putting the record together? Because I feel like lyrically it covers a lot of ground, but it all fits together perfectly. And I feel like, right, let's get into it. I feel that lyrically, the Abysmal Eye, I mean, it seems to be talking about something made that starts to warp and take on this other kind of more sort of menacing aspect, I guess. And I suppose that could be like a bunch of different things. It could be like society as a whole, but or it could be religion or something. But it feels like it's about scientific advancement, specifically with AI.
Yes.
And that's something... Okay, because that's something I'm really interested in. And I feel like the way we're approaching that is, you know, this thing is literally banging on the door wanting to be born. But it's also like the way it's coming about is like we're raising a child already. And if you just feed that child the idea that people are nothing more than data points and things to be exploited, when it finally grows up and becomes its own entity, if that's the root of its being, that's not going to work out particularly well for everyone. I'm obviously like Kurzweil's got this more sort of utopian view of it, but yeah, that's my thoughts anyway.
Yeah, for sure. There's definitely different takes on that, and AI is already used in so much in our phones and everything, and listens to us, and you know, gives us the type of things and that we've been talking about. And you talk about a couch, and all of a sudden your phone starts like popping up ads with couches and stuff. And so AI to a certain degree is already used in that sense. And there was a very interesting and quite kind of a daunting interview with Elon Musk on the subject of AI and his scares about it. And that was also like something that inspired me for writing the lyrics for it. And if people have a minute to, or 45 minutes, I think, to check into that, it's available on YouTube. Just search on Elon Musk AI, and it's quite scary, you know, the possible implications of what it could be, like you said, what it could turn into. So yeah,
there's a lot of things that feel like that's almost like a pivotal thing from what I understand of the lyrics anyway. But is there a larger theme across it all? Because I think that, like, yeah, the development of technologies that are essentially meant to bring us together, and the idea that, you know, the internet was going to be this beautiful thing where everybody communicates and has access to everything, so there's no want. Actually, what it is just been a tool for atomization and creating these little echo chambers. And that seems to be something that's touched on a few times on the record.
Yeah, absolutely. You have the song, the lyrics are written by Morten, Light the Shortening Fuse, which is, you know, straight up about like social media and what it's become and what kind of tool it's become, a tool for idiocy in a lot of ways. And like you said, like echo chamber, and where people that should have never been listened to, and no one would have listened to them 25 years ago, some of them have a huge megaphone and people actually listen to them and take their whatever bullshit they're spewing out for some kind of, you know, verified truth. And it's, I think it's a huge problem, and that's one aspect of it. It's being used as a political tool, to a certain degree also, like this whole, for younger generations, I don't know how they like how you deal with that now if you're 15 years old and growing up in this kind of time and age and with where this is such a thing, and body dysmorphia is like the number one growing sickness of people. It's like, oh, we're supposed to look like this and this and this, and there's filter to make you look like this and this and this, and you can't be yourself. You're not supposed to be yourself. You're supposed to be like some enhanced version of yourself, you know. And then later in life, that, I guess, that goes into the doctor's pockets, because you go and try to fix everything that you think is wrong with you, you know. So I think it's a very dangerous kind of trend that we see, and of course social media has a huge, you know, responsibility for why things are the way they are. I think,
yeah, Armies of the Preposterous obviously, I guess, plays into that as well, with the idea of people being tricked into these kind of abhorrent ideas and then sold lies. I guess that's...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Of a similar
thing. Yeah, I mean, for the lyrics, I mean, it's one of those things that when I do get asked the question, of course I tell people what I am thinking about, or what I'm you know, what's the theme of the lyric and what kind of things it touches on. But at the same time, you kind of want people to make whatever they make out of it too, and I think they will, and that goes for the music as well. You know, what kind of like vibes it gives you, it might not be the same as it does for us, you know, or maybe for us in the band it's not. Every song doesn't even mean the same, you know, but for me, like Armistice of the Preposterous, for example, that's more about like the right wing kind of extreme right, alt-right like movements that we've seen, especially in the last like 10, 15 years rise, you know, the re-rise of that in not only in Europe, but in the world, and kind of those kind of values and weird takes on things that are quite scary, and especially the ones that are even like full on vocal about, like, you know, the extermination of Jews during the Second World War. It didn't happen. It's all made up, and the eradication of this race or these peoples or these tribes that never happened. It's all bullshit, and trying to kind of actively rewrite history, as it were. And that's kind of scary, or it's a lot scary.
Yeah. It's terrifying. Yeah.
It's sad. It's terrifying, and it's very sad. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I agree. Going back to the music a bit then, in that case, there's so many textures across this record and across your entire career, but one thing that obviously I guess a lot of people associate you with is this kind of repetitive sort of syncopation, and these sort of polyrhythmic parts that evolve over the course of something, and they become their own thing, and they twist, and these different slight iterations until you end up somewhere totally different. Which I think is very beautiful, and every time I've seen you play, I find that very hypnotic and quite, without getting too much into it, but I feel it's quite spiritual. I think all art is anyway, and I think that the stuff that moves you is, it touches you in a certain way, and it kind of awakens that thing that's inside a lot of people anyway. Do you find that is that a consideration, like this sort of almost trance-like quality of things?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's one of the, you know, one of the reasons we write the music that we do is we want to provoke something in the listener and in ourselves. I mean, first of all, when we're writing and when we're in creative mode and about to, you know, come out with a new album, we definitely want the songs to do that to us first, like give us like visuals or give us a certain vibe that's almost like palpable, and once you have that, it's crucial to not lose that in the track. And we're not always successful, not at all, but the songs that really kind of where it works, it is a strong point, and something that we feel that we have gotten better at, and it's something that also, you know, it might not be the easiest thing, because it's such a it's such a weird thing to kind of pinpoint what is that exactly. And to a certain degree, I would say that we did not have it on the first album and not on the second and maybe a little bit on the third. And then you kind of slowly get the idea of that more and more, and it becomes more and more important. And in that sense, also, we, you know, with the age and the years that we put in, you do tend to write more for the song. And of course, we have nothing to prove at this point. And that's also maybe, to a certain degree, a freeing aspect of being in this band, that you feel a little more like you don't have to be this or that advanced, or it doesn't have to be nuts all the time. It can provoke other feelings, and sometimes yes, the music might be kind of convoluted and not super straightforward, but it's not our intention to write difficult sounding music. It's just we just try to write something that gives us that vibe or that visual or that gives us a certain, like, this is, oh, I love this, I don't know why, but I love it. And that, having been in this band for so long and having written this type of music for so long, that this is just kind of how it comes out. And it's not about like us trying to be weird or trying, oh, let's, no, we got to go even more nuts, man. It's got to be so people don't understand. Yeah. It's never about that.
Of course.
It's definitely more, you know, more organic than that, which might sound weird to some people, but that's how we feel about it, at least, you know.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's one of the reasons that I'm attracted to your band the way I am. And I think that quite often I'll speak to certain artists that I feel like there is that aspect to their work, and they can be really varied, and it can be, you know, talking to Maynard about Tool, or it can be talking to Aaron from Wolves in the Throne Room, or about Neurosis. You know, there are these bands that have something at the core of them that is like a, this kind of essence to it. And I think a lot of people, this is something I find interesting, is that because your band has been so influential, and I'm not going to say the word, but I feel like there's an aspect of heavy music that looks at your band as almost like the blueprint for where we were going to take things. And they probably, quite a few of those artists don't see that what you're saying. They'll just think it is, we need to be making as convoluted and as complicated sort of polyrhythmic bits and make things as obtuse as possible, and then they miss the entire point of it, because it's about the purity of the art at the center of it, and how you get to that is how you get to that, and it's different for everybody.
Yeah, no, I totally agree, and that's a question we get a lot too, is about like what kind of new bands to listen to, and what kind of bands that are kind of in your genre, or you know, the gent genre, or bands that are kind of up and coming. First of all, I really have no check on anything that's new. I stick to like Pink Floyd and stuff that I kind of grew up with, and Rush and Marillion and stuff, and that's kind of what I listen to still. So I'm first of all not the right guy to ask about that. Yeah. But yeah, I think you're definitely right. I think sometimes you do hear bands, obviously, and before tours we get pitched a lot of bands that we, you know, when we need to figure out who's going to be the opener, what band are we going to bring out for as a main support and stuff like that. And a lot of times we do get pitched stuff that is like that, you know, where it's like, yeah, okay, they're fabulous musicians, like they can do eights around us. But a lot of times I feel like that, but it's missing like that core thing, that the meaning or the essence or something is not there. And then it just becomes difficult music, and difficult music is sometimes very hard to get into. Another aspect of what we do too, yes, we do write a specific style of music that's very convoluted, and we play a lot of riffs that kind of just repeat over the bar line and stuff, but at the same time, you know, we're we're trying to maintain a flow. So most songs, once you have the beat, you know, once you feel it, like, oh, there it is, like, then that's going to go through the whole track. So, I mean, not to say that it's anything wrong with doing, 9/16th notes and 7/8ths and all the like odd time signatures, but it's very hard to headbang to, for example, if you're like so I mean, that's cool, and we for sure grew up with music like that too, with bands like Rush and stuff and King Crimson and stuff, but it's not necessarily as easily enjoyable, you know. It doesn't necessarily make it swing all the time, you know.
Yeah, there has to be that organic element to it that is the people making it, I think.
At least that's how we feel about it. I mean, obviously, you know, there's a lot of successful bands that do music that way too, and nothing wrong with that. But in our personal taste, this is like kind of a very important aspect of what it is we do is to have a flow in the music, you know?
Yeah, I agree. And I think that goes back to what we were saying initially about organizing a set list or organizing a track list for an album. And, I think I'm still, because we're of a similar age, I'm still of the opinion that an album is best enjoyed as an album, as a whole work, because that was how it was created. That was the intention of it. And things are very different now. And that explains why you'll place tracks the way you do, because it creates all these different tones and textures. And, you know, you have moments that can be almost like palate cleansers. And I feel like, a lot of times the way music is consumed these days, which again goes back to what we were saying about, I guess, the advancement of technology, I guess that's lost somewhat.
Yeah. And I think, I think I just had a brain fart, and forgot what I was going to say, but, yeah.
Yeah,
that's there we go. There you have it. Okay. It's a yeah.
Yeah, man. and then finally, you're obviously, as you said, you're gearing up for shows in the near future, and I know that you personally have struggled because of your hands, as I understand it, and everything. Because of eczema, right? That's been making it such a discomfort to play.
Yeah.
Oh, there's two parts to this, actually, because I know that you initially program stuff when you write. So I was curious as to how, if that took any different shape over the course of this because of your hands. And then also, as we were saying about the gearing up for shows, how are you now?
It's been better, but it's kind of up and down. It comes and goes. Well, I've had it for about 2 years, 2.5 years now, and it just kind of started out of the blue. And of course, it has to be in the inside of the hands too. So it's definitely way better than it was, like, say, a year ago or so, where my hands and fingers would be constantly cracked and it would be very painful to play. It had no effect on as far as the creative process. And, you know, like you said, when we write, we program drums and we make everything kind of like a demo. Instead of going into a studio and make demos like we used to, you know, back in the day, we don't really have to do that anymore. The guitar sounds, the bass tone, everything is pretty much the same as what we kind of want for an album. So we record it in the computer world, and we will program drums and kind of make the songs and complete the songs that way. And once that's done and we kind of go into rehearsal mode to record, I just pretty much emulate whatever we have programmed. And that's not necessarily just me. Everyone in the bands are great drum programmers, and they have a very good sense of what you can and what you can't do and how to play, how to program drums to make them sound like it's the real deal and stuff like that. So that's never really an issue. And I really only program drums for the stuff that me and Dick works on. If Morten writes a song, he usually programs the drums for that. And I usually try to, if there's anything, I go in and just touch up like little fills and stuff like that and ghost notes and stuff. Because we put a lot of effort into even the demo stage of things. So we know beforehand pretty much how it's going to come out once it's on an album. So we do put a lot of effort and time into that, and but it's fun, you know. It's a different side of being a musician, to be kind of a lot in the computer environment when you're writing, but it gives us a certain amount of freedom to create whatever it is that we have in our heads. In a sense, you could say the band is actually a product of the tools that we have had at hand, and we wouldn't be this band at all if it wasn't for the software and the kind of where technology has, you know, come in the last like 30 years. And even when I joined the band in 1990, they already were programming. They would play like a Roland R5 drum machines and kind of record that and use Porta Studios and then like ping pong channels back and forth and kind of add guitars and bass that way. And so that was kind of, even before computers, that was already the kind of the go-to way for this band. And the music that we kind of always wanted to hear from ourselves was always a little too convoluted to be something that you just easily jam up by being at the rehearsal and just kind of, oh, let's try this. You know, you kind of have to have those tools. And of course, then by 95, 96, and everyone has a computer and there's software, you know, stuff that you can, you know, program. And then by the late 90s, where Frederick of the band and Matthias Eklund of Toontrack and Daniel Bergstrand, they put together the first like drum kit from hell. After that, we had even our own kind of drum sound that we wanted, instead of using like the Roland R5s was obviously, you know, not the drum sounds that we wanted for this band. But so the tools have really like kind of helped shape us in a way too. And for sure, we would not sound like this at all if this had to be all done, you know, by us in a rehearsal space. Obviously not, no.
Yeah. But you're well now though for the touring.
Oh yeah, about that. Yeah, I mean, I have to tape my fingers a lot, you know, when we rehearse, so I have to tape my thumbs, my index fingers, and my pinkies on both hands, and use quite a lot of tape. And then I have to have gloves on both hands, and like I put grip tape on the sticks and stuff like that too, for that to work out. And I mean, it works, but of course it's, you know, some days I don't feel it at all if the tape holds up and all that, but then again, we have not done this live. And just like what you said when we were talking about like before an album, you can rehearse a track and then you have a cup of coffee and then you play the track again and, you know, talk about it. And you can, you know, take your gloves off and put on more tape or retape. And so we've never done it live. And 1.5 hours of this type of music is something else than just, you know, playing a few tracks in the rehearsal space for sure. So we'll see how it works out. And right now, I mean, I've been talking to nutritionists and stuff too, because the regular doctors and dermatologists, they really had no clue. I've been to every specialist pretty much in Stockholm, and they're just kind of shrugged. You know, they have no clue what this is. And it's not a contact eczema. That's been excluded kind of. So it's more like something that comes from internally. And so I've been talking to nutritionists and stuff, and it seems to be helping. You know, it's definitely better now than it has been. And it seems doable, you know, to play live and all that. So, you know, fingers crossed it doesn't get worse again. So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, I'm very excited about seeing you guys play again, because, as I said, every time I've seen you, it's been really special. So
awesome, man. Thanks.
So thank you for your time as well.
Oh, thank you, Daniel. It was my pleasure.
Great. Well, I'm sure I'll see you when you're over here.
Perfect, man.
Great.
Yes.
Thanks a lot. Thanks
Thanks for listening to episode 45 of Someone Who Isn't Me with myself, Daniel P. Carr. Hello, and my guest Thomas from Meshuggah. Meshuggah's latest album, Immutable, is out now, and I'm sure the band will be playing a bunch of festival stages later this year. If you get the chance to see them, you definitely should. It is stunning. Even if that band isn't necessarily for you, I think that if you see them live and you get it and it clicks in and you suddenly find yourself in that weird trance space that is quite often happening when they play, yeah, it might change your opinion on the band. As I said at the start, I've had this episode on the back burner for a minute, and that's for various reasons, like one of which was the portrait of Thomas, because I always like to use photo references rather than that have been sent to me or that I take myself generally, but obviously this was done over Zoom, so I couldn't do that. I've also got another couple in the bag as well, one with Serge Tankian of System of a Down and solo artist, obviously, and Nikki Six from Motley Crue, but I'm not sure they'll ever get put online, to be fair, because it's not that they're not great. They're both really solid interviews. I just think that the time might have passed. I should definitely be more on top of these, in a way, I think. I'm currently making a list of people that I'd like to have on the podcast in 2023. I am going to make the effort to do more of this. Whether or not it will happen, who knows? I don't know. But if you have any requests for people that you'd like to hear on Someone Who Isn't Me, let me know in the comments or via messages on the socials, which are at Swim Podcast, or via my own pages, which are at Daniel P. Carter. I'd be interested to hear who you'd like to hear me have a conversation with, because if you're a regular listener of the pod and there's somebody you think that I should have on it because for whatever reason, yeah, it'd be interesting to find out. Thank you for listening. Please leave a good review. It always helps. Nice comments. They're all on YouTube now as well. I decided to finally cave in and put all the episodes on YouTube just because I saw that other people were ripping the audio and putting them online. And I figured if we're going to have that, we might as well do it from me directly, because then at least the audio will be decent quality. Thank you for listening. I am out. Peace.